Well, I'd like to begin today's sermon by asking you a question. How would you handle yourself if you were told that you could no longer keep the beliefs you have? How would you handle yourself? Nope, you can no longer keep the beliefs that you have. Imagine you are told that you will be sent to a labor camp or killed if you continue to state you believe what is written in the Bible. How would you handle that? Perhaps we think we know, and I hope we do, but it's an important question to pose and ask ourselves. We all know the story of Daniel and how he handled being told that for 30 days he was not to do what he always did and bow down before God three times each day. What did he do? He disregarded what was said. And he continued to pray to God in spite of knowing the penalty was that he would be thrown into a den of hungry lions if he continued to do this, and of course, as we know, he did. Today, the news stories, now we know that obviously had a good outcome. Today, the news stories we are reading and hearing are reaching a level of corruption that I don't believe I've seen in my lifetime. In fact, beliefs we know God tells us we are to keep are increasingly putting us at odds with many in our government and educational system, what they say we should support. For the first time in Supreme Court history, not that long ago, and the news came out in the last week, that they still haven't been able to figure out who leaked in the Supreme Court the story ahead of time about how things were looking on Roe v. Wade. It clearly was done in an effort to put pressure on the justices as well as energize a particular political base. Currently, we have a sitting Homeland Security Secretary, and he's been doing this for quite a while. I think finally it's beginning to modify or change a bit. But to my knowledge, he's never said anything different other than, and by the way, with a straight face when he does say this, we don't have a border crisis. We don't even have open borders. Meanwhile, thousands of people continue to stream over every day into this country. I believe the number that we are now hitting is 250,000 a month, and that's just the ones that they actually document coming over. That's not considering all the others that managed to work their way in without ever being caught or documented. 250,000 people a month. If I remember correctly, I believe, now again, I realize Denver is much larger than the whole greater area, but the city population of Denver itself is a little less than 250,000. So imagine this coming in every month. Meanwhile, we're being told, no, we don't have an open border. We happen to have government officials and powerful teachers' unions stating that parents should not be fighting against the education system because elementary age school children, for example, should be able to choose for themselves and for if they want. They should know all about sex and sexual preference so they can choose what they want to be when they're 5 or 6 years old. As though they have that right from God, by the way. I'm not even bringing up the fact that the president of Russia is doing all he can to wipe an entire country off the face of the map. It would be fair to say that we are living in and surrounded by a world gone mad. This world hates God, just as God hates sin. So back to my original question. How would you handle yourself if you were told that you could no longer keep the beliefs that you hold? Today I'd like to go back and take a look at an example of a woman in the Bible who turned to God for help. Her name was Esther. Esther faced a most difficult set of circumstances, and she chose not to back down, but rather to stand tall and stand strong. As we take a look at her story today, consider what we see in the world around us and compare how she handled what she faced with with how today's world and today's leaders handle issues or circumstances that they face. There are important lessons we can draw from her life that most of this world, frankly, can't appreciate. And the reason they can't appreciate it is because most of mankind is enamored with sin rather than enamored with the truth of God. I thought it was interesting, the verse we're reading in James in the sermonette today, which frankly reiterated this point. I was reading that, you know, you read different things. I'm sure you do the same thing. I know from my standpoint and what I do, sometimes I'm reading something someone's sharing and something catches my thought for a bit, and here's a good sermon idea. There was something that pulled out, and I want to thank Mr. Johnson for that. Doesn't always happen this way, but it's nice when you read something, you think, oh, I need to flesh that out. That's a good idea. It's hard to wrap my mind around much of what I read in today's news. I've come to see, as many of you have, that the mind of man is simply sick and in need of healing. Satan, as the father of lies, has taken hold of this world and made it his. Stories that Hollywood comes up with in the form of futuristic films is so often what we see actually playing out today. If you go back and look at old science fiction movies, you look at today and go, wow, this is here. I'm sure if time were allowed to proceed, we'd probably see the Hunger Games unfold in real life. History tells of some incredible stories. The saying, truth is stranger than fiction, has proven quite true quite often. The need for the return of Jesus Christ, fellow family members, is greater than ever. As one reads through the pages of the Bible, stories are told of miracles, controversies, intrigue, and peace. History lessons are given and future events are depicted. Today, in books or at the movies, people are interested in power, murder, lust, revenge, and often they still want and expect a peaceful, happy ending within 2 hours. There's a fascination with stories that tell of emotional outbursts involving vanity and greed. There's an obsession over the afterlife. Vampires, ghosts, horror films, and every kind of demented thought imaginable. Why? Well, because the God of this world, the prince of the power of the air, the prince of darkness, Satan the devil, has convinced most all human beings that God's word, it's antiquated. It's restricting. It holds us back from true freedom. The story of Esther and her cousin, who serves as her father named Mordecai, is one in which we can compare and contrast with what we see today. It's a story of a strong woman spiritually, and I hope that both men and women in God's church can draw true appreciation from her story. It, like so many other stories in the Bible, has powerful lessons for us to learn from. But since many of those stories involve men, today we will focus on a woman named Esther. Esther's story is a story about the attempted genocide of the Jews. A decree ordered the extermination of young and old men, women, and children. The place, Persia. The time, 5th century BC. The book of Esther describes how this crisis was averted through her bravery, the wisdom of her stepfather, and the help of God Almighty. Now, before we get into the book, let's consider a little background of the history of the book. So for those of you who are note takers, you can put down what you would like up front. It is, first of all, important to understand that the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther form the closing section of Old Testament history. They tell the story of the Jews returning from Babylon, the rebuilding of the Temple of Jerusalem, and the reestablishment of the Jews' national life in their homeland. They cover a period of about 100 years, 536 to 432 BC. In fact, the last of the three prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, lived and gave their instruction and prophecies in this era of the Jews' restoration. The timeline is pretty well understood to be from 536 to 516. It was a 20-year period in which under Zerubbabel, the governor, and Joshua, the priest, the temple was rebuilt. And you can read about that in Ezra 3 through 6. To this period belonged Haggai and Zechariah. Then skipping to 457 to 432 was a period of 25 years in which under Nehemiah, the governor, and Ezra, the priest, the wall was rebuilt, Jerusalem was restored as a fortified city, and this period belonged to Malachi. Now, in between these two periods of time fell the story of Esther, who would become queen in 478 B.C. You know, it's very evident as you go through this and many other stories told in the Bible that God does and will continue to take care of those who honor Him and those who make wise decisions as a result of their honor. I know all of us are aware of the promise made to Abraham covering his descendants, and we certainly recognize this to be true all the way through today and until the return of Jesus Christ. But there have been times in history that in order for God to fulfill that promise, that He had to take on a very hands-on approach, or Satan would have thwarted His plans. We are reminded of this even in the story of Esther. So let's go ahead and turn to the book of Esther. You might already be there. Excuse me for a moment. I'm going to confuse whoever puts the waters up here. I'm taking the one on the right this time. I think last time I took the one on the left. Just keeping somebody on their toes, that's all. Try to be a balanced man, Mr. Johnson. Esther 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces, from India to Ethiopia. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. So, first off, Ahasuerus's Greek name, just for those of you who enjoy facts and information, his Greek name was Xerxes, which is X-E-R-X-E-S. That was Ahasuerus's Greek name. He was the son and successor of Darius I, at the beginning of whose reign the restoration of the Jerusalem temple took place. The capital city of the Persian Empire was called Shushan or Susa, S-U-S-A, as your margin probably informs you. In Susa was where the story of Esther took place, as this is where the citadel or fortified palace of Ahasuerus was. Now, I think it's interesting to note that the policy of the Assyrian and the Babylonian kings was to deport or take away any conquered peoples from their own land and scatter them into other lands. That was what they did when they conquered. I suppose we could say this is not unlike what the white man did to the Indians in this country, or the Nazis did to the Jews. On the other hand, the policy of the Persian kings was just the opposite. The Persian kings would send back to their own land any conquered people, which was much more humane. For example, one of the first acts of the first Persian king, Cyrus, was to authorize the return of the Jews to their own land. Now, I find this interesting because of what took place in the story of Esther. Genocide would have been much easier, wouldn't it, if all those being killed were found to be primarily in one spot? If you're going to wipe somebody out, rather than have to go all over to find these people to kill, if they're all in one location, it's easier to just go ahead and and kill them there, right, in one spot. So this story in Esther shows and reminds us of just how powerful God's hand is. No matter what the odds, no matter what the situation, God can and will take care of his faithful people, no matter how few and no matter how together or how scattered. And in light of what we've all seen in the last 25 plus years in this country and in the church, frankly, I take great comfort in that. Verse 3 then tells us of a feast that Ahasuerus hosts for all the leaders throughout the 127 provinces that were included in the Persian Empire. Notice verse 4. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. So the Persian Empire was so expansive and that Ahasuerus was so proud of what he had, he took 180 days to party with all his officials. If someone gave you a 180-day vacation, first of all, it's hard to wrap our minds around, isn't it? But we're talking about great wealth. He probably told the same story over to each group of leaders that he had in on different days, boasting and exaggerations that grew over time, just like the fish story. Verse 5. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days. So he had 180 days, and then when that ends, you got this final big blowout feast for 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now, picking up in verse, so he has this 7 day feast for all of them that worked in the and lived in the palace. Verse 6. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars. And the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. They served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. Verse 8 says, in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So here we are shown just how much Ahasuerus had and how much he obviously gloated over what he had. It is pointed out that each person had a cup from a different set so that nobody had the same. So what this means is I found somebody that has more dishes than my wife. She didn't know I was going to say that. He apparently was most happy to brag about and point out the abundance in the land. Then notice in verse 9 the name of his wife and the fact that she too was throwing a feast of her own for the women of the palace. Queen Vashti, verse 9, also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Obviously, the culture was one in which men and women did not feast together. It was not appropriate for the women to do so. Verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, and I'm not going to bother reading all these different fun names to pronounce here, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. So Ahasuerus, still in this vein of showing off, wanted to do the same with his wife Vashti. Come on in here, dear, and let me parade you in front of everybody. So he apparently wanted to parade her as much as he did any of his other belongings. But for whatever reason, Vashti chose not to come. Verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, do you think the king took it well? No, he took it just the way we figure he would take it. He was furious, and his anger burned within him. And the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew the law and justice, those closest to him, being, and they list several of them right here, 7 princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom, What shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus and brought to her by the eunuchs? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Again, we don't know here at this point why she chose not to come and not to respond, but it obviously caused quite the stir. For the queen's behavior, verse 17, will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report. King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. Well, this very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. It really does seem like some sort of movie, doesn't it? Imagine how women, for that matter, most men, would react today to this type of behavior. Obviously, at that time, as seen in this example, men were, in many people's eyes and minds, a higher class citizen than women. So Ahasuerus listens to one of his top officials and likes what he hears and makes a decree so that Vashti is removed. The feeling is that this will stem any tide of uprising that other women might consider. Chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all his beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. So here we see that apparently Ahasuerus was thinking about Vashti and must have been rather blue about what happened, and those around him recognized this, and so they suggested to Ahasuerus that he take his time and choose from all the most beautiful young women throughout Persia to become his queen. It really is kind of like a movie watching on TV. It sounds like a Disney movie already. It's not a Disney movie, mind you, but you can see the parallels from what they so often seem to draw from. In verse 5, we are then introduced to one of the main characters in the story of Esther. His name was Mordecai, her cousin and adopted father. Verse 5, in Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives, who'd been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had been carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So again, we see here that Mordecai raised Esther, who coincidentally was a beautiful young girl, and becoming, as time progressed, a beautiful woman. So beautiful that when the decree that had been made by Ahasuerus, Esther was taken to the king's palace along with all the other young, beautiful women. But notice how Esther is taken care of once inside the palace walls. By the way, we too are taken care of by God when we stand for the truth. We're given special treatment by God in that we are given peace of mind. And we are many times given added physical blessings as well. Verse 8, so it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Hegai, that Esther was also taken to the king's palace into the care of Hegai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance, Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. So Esther was given special favor that the other women were not. Now, perhaps we should stop here for a moment and address a thought or two. It's not clear as to whether or not Esther was very happy about being taken to the palace, or whether she did it out of respect to Mordecai, and that's all. But that aside, it is clear that for whatever reason, God gave her a special blessing. I can't help but wonder, however, if the reasoning behind this is not cleared up a bit in the next verse, verse 10. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. What's the point that we can draw from this, or certainly a point? Esther obviously respected and was loyal to Mordecai. And brethren, I hope we all know what a beautiful, rewarding, and godly trait that really is. This points out the first lesson that I would like to stress concerning Esther's story. God blesses us and God protects us when we show him through our actions that we understand loyalty and respect to him and to those who are our caregivers or our parents. Now, hopefully we think of this often. We certainly are not living in a society that teaches this, as we've already seen. God does expect us to honor and to respect him. He also expects us to show loyalty and respect to each other, so long as all parties yield themselves to God and his truth. Now, I say that there are those that certainly do just the opposite. And we are to love our fellow man, including our enemy, as God loves us. That's what we're taught. Some people are easier to love than others, aren't they? But the truth of the matter is, there's a certain standard and expectation that God has for all of us and how we deal with any other human being. But what we see very clearly here, or hope we take away this point, is God really appreciates loyalty and respect. And loyalty is surely one of the healthier fruit-bearing attributes found within a man or a woman of God. Perhaps we could use another term for loyalty that we hear often today but rarely see, and that is commitment. Esther was loyal. She was committed, as we will see not only here, but in upcoming passages, to Mordecai, to her people, and ostensibly to God. Are you loyal? Are you committed to our loving eternal Father and to his church? There are many people who are not committed many women who are not committed to their husbands, and as a result, that ultimately leads to affairs or divorce or both. There are many husbands that are not committed to their wives, and it leads to exactly the same thing. You see, God holds wives, with rare exception, to respect their husband. And I say with rare exception, meaning if the husband's being dishonest, straying within the relationship of the marriage, vows were made under what is later found to be fraud, those would be exceptions. But again, do you as a wife respect your husband? Well, that's an important part of a strong marriage. Just as the man is to give his life and sacrifice for his wife as Christ sacrificed for you and me, the wife is to respect her husband. That's what the Bible teaches. In this case, we see Esther respecting her uncle, Mordecai, and as the story shows, God blesses her for that. From verses 11 through 14, you can read about what all the various young women went through before being presented to the king, after which the ladies were placed in another area and kept as concubines. But notice again in verse 15 that God rewarded Esther with special blessing. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Verse 16 says, so Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. She clearly found special favor in Haggai's sight, as well as then the sight of Ahasuerus, and so she becomes the queen. At this point, the story takes a turn. We read about a plot to take the life of Ahasuerus. Chapter 2, verse 20. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. So Ahasuerus did not know, for example, she was a Jew. Continuing in verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, a big Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So here we see that because of Mordecai, Ahasuerus' life was saved. And the two men who conspired to kill the king were hanged. Yet even after this, Mordecai was not recognized by the king or rewarded for this information, which was not the norm. Rather, the story continues, and we meet Haman, an Amalekite. Haman became the favorite of Ahasuerus, and as we will see, was given great authority all too carelessly by Ahasuerus. Chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. And the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened when they spoke to him daily that he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage, Haman was filled with wrath. So here we see the stereotypical human reaction. I am something, and you should note that I am something special. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. So not only am I going to get back at him, but I'm really going to get back at him. I'm going to go after everybody. Everybody that he loves. Everybody that he would care about. His lineage. His whole line. It's an obvious case of vanity leading to anger and a desire to murder. This is the second point that I wish to bring out from this story. Look at the fruit produced from vanity. Look at what comes out of vanity. It is never anything good. Haman's ego was such that he not only wanted to get back at Mordecai, he wanted to wipe out all of the Jews. So, in order to do this, he decided to do so under the guise that these people were threats to Ahasuerus. And he points it out to the king. He even went as far as to offer money to the king if the king would issue a decree to wipe out the Jews. Why? Because he knew that would also appeal to King Ahasuerus. We've already seen that he loves to show everybody what he's got. So I'm going to offer you more. Oh, that sounds wonderful. Only thing is, Haman didn't refer to any specific tribe or group when he's sharing this with Ahasuerus, but merely those who do not keep the king's laws. So Ahasuerus, being the kind of guy he was, thought, hey, that sounds pretty good. He would have that many more riches. So he agreed to the deal, and Haman then sent out this decree as though from the king to all 127 provinces, stating that all the Jews, including women and children, were to be wiped out, annihilated, wiped from the face of the earth. And this was to be done at the time decided by casting of lots. As it turned out, the lot fell on the 12th month, so Haman had to wait a while. But he was willing to do so, because in his mind, I know what's coming and I'm going to have my revenge. But Mordecai got word of this, and so he cried out with a loud and bitter cry, according to verse 1 in chapter 4. And then in verse 3, we can read that as the decree arrived throughout the 127 provinces, that there was great mourning among the Jews. Obviously, Ahasuerus didn't realize that he was being taken advantage of, and he was oblivious to what was being sent out by Haman. Again, look at the fruit of vanity. The fruit of vanity of those people today who choose to ignore what God says and do what they want to do ultimately leads to a lot of destruction. Just as Ahasuerus was a leader then who was oblivious in so many ways, what do we see today in our world? Leaders that are oblivious to things that they should not be oblivious to. Now, God has to call people, and we all understand that. And he's obviously only calling a very small number as first fruits. But you read this story and you think, wow, this has got a lot of similarities to what's going on today, because human nature is still the same. Well, again, the fruit of vanity for those people today who choose to ignore what God says and do what they want to do will ultimately lead to destruction. That's what is forecast to happen to this nation. We will someday be under captivity. That's what the prophets of old share with us in the Bible. You can just put in your notes Jeremiah 30. When you ignore what God says and you put your own ideas ahead of what God says, it always leads to devastation on all fronts. Esther enters the picture once again. Let's pick up her story. In chapter 4. Chapter 4 and verse 5. Then Esther called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn why this was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given to Shushan that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her. In other words, no, this isn't just something I heard or thought I might have heard. No, here's the document that even shows this. This is the decree. That he might command her to go to the king and to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. So now Esther's been told and has seen with her own eyes that the written decree that has caused such an uproar and caused people to fast. But as we are about to see, she felt caught because she wasn't sure she could, and she certainly did not know, how to bring it up to Ahasuerus. Let's notice this in verse 10. Esther spoke to Hathach and gave a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king, who's not been called, well, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. What was Mordecai's response to this? Esther's saying, look, I'm not sure how to handle this because I can't go in before the king. I'm not supposed to do that without being requested, or frankly, I could lose my life. So picking up in verse 13, Mordecai told them to answer Esther. Don't think, Esther, in your heart, that you will escape all the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Mordecai reminds Esther that even though she is the queen and within palace walls, look, she's not going to be able to escape with her life if this decree is fulfilled. Then comes the next lesson I would like to consider from the story of Esther. She showed wisdom. She asked Mordecai for advice. That's wise. And she took it. And I firmly believe that all mothers in the church who prove themselves to be dedicated to the Word of God seek advice from God, just as all husbands or fathers who do. When we seek advice from God and we continue to live His way, then we end up showing significant wisdom. Verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day, not just a day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." In other words, I'm going to put this in God's hands. Don't want it in my own. I want it in God's hands, and I want God to know what we need. Continuing in verse 17, so Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. What did Esther want? She wanted God's guidance. She wanted His direction. She wanted His protection. When we're in time of trouble, time of difficulty, or simply a time when we have drifted from God, do we take time to stop, make a wise decision, perhaps fast and pray, certainly pray, and ask God for His direction and His help? Esther showed wisdom by first going to God before she did anything else. She asked that the Jews do the same. It's a wonderful and powerful example for everyone. I sure wish the leadership of this nation thought like this. Hold your place here in Esther, and let's turn to Colossians chapter 4. Colossians 4. Colossians 4, and let's begin in verse 2. Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. And by the way, as we're reading this, think about you, think about the story we're reading. Is this something that would be said about how you handle things? Meanwhile, praying also for us that God would open to us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in chains, that I may make it manifest as I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Paul is describing here many aspects of what a Christian is to be practicing. It takes a wise person to ponder and then practice these attributes. It takes a wise person to go to God first, so that our actions are premeditated rather than reactive. Esther was wise in taking her concerns and her situation to God first. If our nation's leadership took their concerns to God first and actually followed what he said, imagine what a different nation this would be. You and I, as true Christians, definitely should appreciate what this is telling us and why it's important. Following closely on the heels of wisdom shown by Esther, then came courage, as we see in the last sentence in verse 16 of chapter 4 in Esther, and as we will see in chapter 5 as well. I believe we would all agree that it would take a lot of courage to do something knowing you might lose your life over it. You can't do that if you don't have courage. Do you have the courage to listen to and then follow God's word? Do you have the courage that Esther had? Before we go back to Esther, turn with me to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew 7. And let's notice what's shared with us here by Jesus Christ, beginning in verse 13, something that should be quite familiar to us. Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way, which leads to life, and there are few who find it. It really does take courage to answer the call, to truly dedicate your life to the more narrow and challenging way. You know, we have the opportunity. Sometimes I think people think, well, you know, I want to fight this because this isn't good for our society. I want to fight that. I want to get involved in this. This is a good cause for me to get behind. And on the surface, it can sure seem that way. But when you begin to think about God and God's plan and God's way, and you recognize that, frankly, any involvement that we get involved in the machinery of man today is rather futile, isn't it? Because ultimately, man really isn't interested in listening to God. So we need Jesus Christ to return rather than spend a lot of time investing in, well, I think this would be a good cause to get behind. What we need to do is get behind what God says and implement that in our lives. So it takes courage to answer the call and to truly do to dedicate your life to the more narrow and challenging way of life. A way of life that is beautiful, exciting, trying but rewarding. Every time I read this passage, I find myself thinking about how many people try to deter us by saying something like, all these people can't be wrong. Or, are you still trying to earn salvation? Ha! What's wrong with you? Or, do you really think that God made things to be this hard? You know, the truth is, Satan loves to discourage. But of course, when we focus on who God is and what he can do for us, just as Esther did in her example, a difficult, quote-unquote, path just doesn't matter. All right, that's what I need to walk. I'm happy to do it. Let's go back to Esther and pick up the story in chapter 5, verse 1. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter. And Esther went near, touched the top of the scepter. So here we see the protection and the blessings God worked out for Esther, and he also works out for us when we do the right things, when we are wise, when we go to God and we pray and we fast and we ask for direction and guidance and inspiration and protection. If more mothers focused on the responsibilities God has given them as mothers today, as opposed to pursuing selfish objectives, imagine how different this world would be. And the same can be said about men, but since we're using an example here of Esther, I'm just saying women. If our leadership wanted to follow the word of God, male or female, rather than find ways to befriend wealthy socialites who will give them money for their campaigns, what a different nation this would be. Esther was given favor by the king. Or we could say he gave her his ear, and it was all because she turned to God. She was faithful to him. She put her trust in him. The king proceeds to tell Esther that whatever her request is, he will grant her that request up to half of his kingdom. Verse 4. So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." And the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half of the kingdom. It shall be done." Then Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." Now the king was probably quite puzzled. What was all this secrecy about? What exactly does she have in mind here? Esther's request. But he also seems quite intrigued. After all, it's apparent that he enjoyed being catered to, and I would imagine he saw this as some sort of a little game in which he was being catered to, and so he probably was pretty excited about it. Well, so was the case with Haman. He really thought, well, hey, I'm in tight with the king and with the queen after all. Mordecai and the Jews were about to be removed. And he was the only one that was invited, along with the king, to this special banquet given by Esther. Wow, what could possibly be more good to happen to one man? He was on top of the world. Verse 9 of chapter 5. So Haman went out that day, joyful, with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, oh, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Oh, he comes out all, Mordecai? Mordecai had a lot of power over him because he gave that power to Mordecai when you really think about it, right? Sure didn't take long for Haman to be reminded of how much he despised Mordecai. However, he tried to hold it in until that appointed time, as was indicated by Purim or Lot, which we know fell on the 12th month. Verse 10. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself. He went home and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Jeresh. And Haman told them of his great riches. Honey, let me tell you. The multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, besides all of that, honey, listen to this. Queen Esther invited no one but me to come with the king and to the banquets that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. Oh, honey, I am climbing this ladder. Look where I am. Here we once again see arrogance. Vanity, showing off that he wanted to do with all that he had, concerning everything he had. The fruit of vanity is truly quite ugly. This is the same thing I see in those who continue to choose to disobey God. Their vanity is ugly and it is hurtful to God. What God sees in this nation must sicken him terribly. Verse 13. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. So every time he gets excited, then he thinks about Mordecai. And it's like this dark cloud just weighing him down again. So his wife Zeresh and all the friends said to him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high. And in the morning suggested the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. What a brilliant idea, baby. Ha ha, this is great. I'm going to do this. Well, this was taking place. That very night, the king had trouble sleeping. When God intervenes, he intervenes in very dramatic ways, doesn't he? Once again, God chooses to intervene on behalf of Mordecai, who had been loyal, showed wisdom himself, as well as courage and patience. Surely one of the more exciting principles given to us time and time again as we read through these stories is how enlightening it is to see faithful people delivered by the hand of God. I find these stories invigorating to me personally, and I always end up asking myself, could this be me? Am I willing to put God first? Am I really willing to put all on the line for him? So again, Mordecai was about to be rewarded by God through Ahasuerus. Chapter 6, verse 1. That night the king could not sleep, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers, who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, by the way, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? What did we give Mordecai, who's the one who saved my life? The king's servants who attended him said, well, nothing. So the king said, well, who's in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, well, Haman's there, standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman thought in his heart, as Haman would do, well, who would the king delight to honor more than me? To the king, this was an innocent enough question, but one that he was looking forward to having answered so that he could reward Mordecai. But Haman was certain that Ahasuerus was talking about him. This is kind of a Disney movie now, isn't it? You think about it. Can't you see this happening? This is... Once again, his vanity and pride stood out. Haman goes on in verses 7 through 9 to explain, probably in rather glowing terms, what reward should be bestowed upon this wonderful person that the king described. Verse 7. And Haman answered the king, because of course he's thinking, well, this is going to be for me. So, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let's see here. How about let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on his head? Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then, oh, by the way, let's parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Verse 10. So the king said to Haman, all right, hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested and do so for, oh boy, Mordecai, the Jew who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, led him on horseback through the city square, proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor, probably with a frog in his throat as he's doing it. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, But Haman, like a wounded puppy with his tail between his legs, hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. Haman had to be beside himself. This was almost the ultimate in humiliation. He had to parade Mordecai around the capital city in such a way that he himself wanted to be paraded. Once again, as the old saying goes, don't ever get too big for your own britches. Chapter 7 then brings us back here to the banquet prepared by Esther for Ahasuerus and Haman. Chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you, and what is your request? Up to half of the kingdom, it shall be done." Then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Well, who is this? And where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" Verse 6 says, and Esther said, "The adversary and the enemy is the wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Imagine how you would feel if you were in Haman's shoes right then. The planned genocide that had been orchestrated by Haman, it appeared, would not occur. Now, I would imagine that Haman found it rather hard to swallow any more food or wine at that point. Then the king became quite angry. He left the table. He went into the palace garden, upon which time Haman tried one last-ditch effort to save his life. He turned to Esther, looking for mercy, as he was sure he would not receive it from Ahasuerus. But the problem was that it was not the proper etiquette to stay in the room alone with a queen or with a lady. He should have left the room when the king did. Verse 8. When the king returned from the palace garden, to the palace of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. And the king said, "Will you also assault the queen while I'm in the house?" And as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. I'd like to read to you from the Tyndale Old Testament commentary regarding this verse, as I feel this helps paint the picture of this time. Quote, "Etiquette with regard to the harem was so strict that it would have been difficult for Haman to converse with the queen without causing offense. Had he not been so desperate, he would no doubt have left with the king so as to avoid any possible misinterpretation of his remaining behind with the queen. In approaching her, as she continued to recline on her couch, as was customary at Persian feasts, Haman was going too far. And by falling on the couch, quote unquote, he set the seal on his execution. Even had she wished to help, there was nothing Esther could have done to save him. The king was outraged. They covered Haman's face, implies the presence of retainers at hand to carry out the king's intentions, though the practice of covering the heads of condemned prisoners by the Persians in ancient times is otherwise unattested. It was the custom among the Greeks and Romans," end of quote. Let's pick up the story in verse 9. "Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, 'Look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman.' Then the king said, 'Hang him on it.' So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's wrath subsided." So, as is the case in so many times throughout the Bible, God not only provided protection for those who turned to him, he also removed the threat. He removed the threat entirely by removing Haman. Just as so many of our mothers have great strength, we see the strength that Esther had in this story. She understood where to turn And it's certainly my hope that each woman or mother otherwise in here knows where to turn as well. But this valuable lesson also stems to we men in that we are to follow God and obey Him no matter what as well. You know, so long as that's the case, no matter what the leadership of our country does, God's going to take care of us. Mothers, teach your children what God shows us in His Word, as this is one of the most important tasks that God gives you. We may be living in a country that is trying to tell us that the education system should have the authority to teach our children what they feel should be taught. But God expects mothers and fathers to be the primary teachers and the Word of God, the primary textbook. In chapter 8, we find that Esther is given Haman's home and Mordecai is given the signet ring that was once given to Haman. Ahasuerus tells Esther and Mordecai to write a decree reversing what Haman wrote. And so a letter was sent to all 127 provinces. Let's pick up the story in chapter 8 and verse 9. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, in the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. So this is still 9 months before, that said the third month, 9 months before the 12th month, right? Because remember, the lot fell in the 12th month. It was going to be a while before this was going to take place. So this, we did not read, but in verse 7 of chapter 3, it is stated that the 12th month, Adar, or Adar, A-D-A-R, was the time chosen for the massacre. So all this story involving Haman and his anger towards Mordecai, followed by Haman's death, took place over a two-month period. Notice verse 10 as we continue here in chapter 8, And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding all on royal horses bred from swift steeds. And by these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Verse 13 says, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Skipping down to chapter 9 and verse 1. Now in the 12th month, that was on the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. And on the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all people. And all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for this man Mordecai became increasingly prominent. And verse 5 says, thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. The story goes on to tell about Haman's 10 sons being killed and hanged. And this all took place on the 13th day of the 12th month, followed by a feast on the 14th day, according to verse 17 of chapter 9. Then as you read further in the chapter, you find that Esther, along with Mordecai, are given a prominent position in Jewish history. They exhibited loyalty to one another. They exhibited wisdom. They exhibited courage. And they were loyal in going to God. For those things, God rewarded them. As Esther turned to God for help, we need as well to always turn to God. Society around us is not well. The only path that makes any sense to follow is what God teaches. So, to go back to the question I posed at the beginning of the sermon today, how would you handle yourself if you were told you could no longer keep the belief that you hold, or you would be killed? Esther's story is one that shows us where to turn. Let's all be sure to follow Esther's example of going to God and following his lead. Let's make sure that we ask for courage and that we show courage when that's what's needed. This will please God, and it will be a great benefit to your physical family and ultimately your spiritual family.